Hi, my name's Dan Seaman.
And I'm Jeremy Austin.
And welcome to the Perseen Podcast,
where we talk to industry experts and explore topics of interest to internet service providers and network experts everywhere.
Hello, and welcome back to episode 5 of the Perseen Podcast. I'm Dan Seaman, Chief Product Officer of Perseen.
I'm your co-host, Jeremy Austin, our Senior Product Manager. We've got a really great show for you today. This is our second show with a guest, and we want to do a lot more of this. We really enjoy having people around. But before I introduce our guest, I just want to mention that we have coming up really soon our third virtual online summit for ISPs. This has been really popular. We started the first one way back in COVID days, and that's proven to be a really fantastic virtual event for ISPs, both wireline and wireless. So we have a 2-day remote event currently scheduled for February 14th and 15th. If you aren't able to make that live, be sure to check out our YouTube channel. We'll have all these sessions up there. The link is ispvirtualsummit.com, and there's going to be some fantastic sessions on, you know, fixed wireless and fiber, quality of experience, which is of course our wheelhouse here at Perseen, measuring customer churn, how to use data in your business. And for the first time, we're going to have a founder AMA. So Dan, Scott, and Garrett will be getting together and taking your questions live. So that's going to be a really fun session. I'm looking forward to that. And if it's anything like we've had in the previous years, it's been really well attended, and we've got really great feedback on that. That's going to be completely free. So be sure to check that out, ispvirtualsummit.com. Our guest today is Bjørn Ivar Teigen. He's from Oslo, Norway, which is a number of time zones away from where I am here in Alaska. So I got up early, and Dan's kind of in the middle, and Bjørn's got it kind of late on the far side. So say hi, Bjørn.
Hey, guys. Thanks for having me.
It's wonderful to have you. We met through a mutual interest in Buffer Bloat, and we've had some really fun conversations since we met last month. So Bjørn Ivar is head of research at Domos. Did I say that right?
Domos, yeah.
Domos. Okay, yeah. Awesome. We'll hear about shortly, but he's been working with ISPs and application developers to improve latency on the internet. He received a PhD on latency modeling and optimization in December of 2022, which is really cool that now that you can get a degree in that. We think that's awesome. And contributes to standardization work in the Broadband Forum and at the IETF, which if you've been in the ISP space for some time, you understand that that's where the research and development happens that become the practices and protocols that we use on the internet of the future, not just the internet of today. So let's talk a little bit, kind of in this first half of the podcast, we're going to talk about one of our favorite topics, latency and quality of experience, which we haven't done yet, I think, on this podcast. Is that right, Dan?
Yeah, I don't think we've really spent much time talking about much of what we do at all at a high level. Yeah. But yes, certainly we have not done any kind of deep dive into latency and why it's important.
Well, okay, so let's start with that. And I'll hear from you first, Dan, playing host here for a minute, since both of you fellows know far more about this than I do. I'm going to pretend that I'm the dumb audience here, by which I mean all of our audience is extremely intelligent and perspicacious. So tell us, what is latency in the network experience? What causes it? And generally, what approaches that we collectively take to measure? Because I know there's going to be a little bit of difference between the way Perseen and Domos do things. So it'll be interesting to hear from you on that.
Yes. So I think that the main thing there is, for a long time, hardware was and networks in general were kind of over-optimized for throughput. And you can get higher throughput if you have deeper buffers and you do more aggregation and you can do all these kind of things. But a lot of the customer experience is latency driven. So think the things like quick lookups for DNS, or even how quickly flows are going to ramp up for web requests and things like that. So this kind of over-focus on throughput led to the general buffer bloat problems that we could talk about in much more detail. And it's really just led to this situation where when links get busy, the experience gets really bad. Like, I think everybody's probably had this experience where a link at 90% feels fine, and then a link, especially like a backhaul or something, at 95 or 100, it just is garbage. And fundamentally, that's coming from there's too much buffering, and that's impacting the latency and causes that poor experience. So we have this other talk that we've done a bunch of times where we explain a little bit about where latency comes from. And I think there's for some people, an kind of an initial misconception that latency is strictly like propagation. Like, how long does it take to get from A to B? And the reality is for most access networks, that's just not a concern at all. Like, the speed of light, the speed of electrons and copper, it's fast enough that you just don't need to care about that. And even if you did care about it, you really can't do that much about it anyway. So the reality is it's buffering that is driving latency. It's too much buffering. Packets are queued up waiting to be transmitted. You do need to have some amount of buffering to maintain good link utilization, but too much causes a lot of pain. So measuring that, identifying when the links have hit that point, staying below them, and or actively managing the traffic to make sure that those queues don't build up is ultimately how we keep latency good and keep that experience good even under load. So
we'll definitely talk more about, you know, how we mitigate that problem, but let me just ask a follow-on question, which would be like, why isn't it just simply, you know, back to the problem of trying to cram more bits down a pipe than it can hold, why isn't it just that we just cram the bits down as fast as we can? Like, why do we have to buffer explicitly?
Because if there's not any buffering at all, we get very poor link utilization.
So we're never able to fill the pipe up.
Right. If you don't have enough buffers, then the transmit side's going to run out and you're never going to think full utilization. But if you have too much, you're queuing extra packets and that just adds latency. It doesn't add throughput.
Yeah. I mean, this is a really good summary. I think one of the reasons why this maximizing for throughput ends up creating this buffer block problem is that the transport protocols in the internet are really sensitive to packet loss. So there's an incentive when you're building just a box or a router or something in the network and you're testing it for maximum throughput. You really want to avoid packet loss at all costs because that's going to impact your test scores when you're evaluating whether or not you're hitting the targets, right? So the incentive in that case is to make the buffer so large that packet loss is very unlikely. And because you're not measuring latency when you're running those tests anyway, you end up getting better scores and or having a bigger chance of getting good scores on those kinds of tests.
And it's two things there. It's not measuring latency, and partially that's because it's just harder than measuring throughput. But it's also a lot of those tests are going to be single fat flows, which is a very different thing than real internet traffic in terms how much buffering you need.
So the internet is not primarily composed of these giant flows like you'd have in a lab. I mean, no, there's test equipment. In fact, we use this test equipment in the lab where we can generate, you know, thousands, if not millions of flows. What's the difference in behavior there between, you know, say that single fat flow and then a bunch of flows that are contending?
I think one of the big differences is that when you have a lot of competing flows that are sort of from different sources and different people or different entities are creating them, then from the perspective of each of the flows, the link is going to be seen as variable because you're sharing it with, for 1 second, you might have the link by yourself because there are no other flows. And then the next second, you're suddenly sharing it with 10 other flows. So from your point of view, the link, the actual available bandwidth of that link dropped from you get 100% to you get like 10%. Mm-hmm. So that if it's just the one flow, then the link is a very stable thing that you can sort of view over time and get a model of and understand how that link behaves. But in the real internet, you're sharing the link, whether that's a wireless link or a wired link or whatever, you're sharing it with other people and their behavior is, from your point of view, pretty much random.
And I think what you touched on earlier is the key point there. Like when the U in that sentence is kind of like TCP. Right? Yeah. Because TCP is probing to try to figure out how much bandwidth's available. And when it suddenly shifts, it's going to be dumping too much stuff in the network. It gets packet loss. And then we get this retransmit loop. The application perceives latency. It has to retransmit the segments again. So think of TCP as always trying to model the network internally for each flow. And if the best way to make one flow not see any loss is to give it a lot of buffering. But it just does not play well once you have real traffic doing other things.
I think you could go a little bit further, Dan, with the nomenclature as well to even claim that it's really any traffic control algorithm.
Yeah, that's right.
BBR or, any of them, you know, if you're using UDP and are attempting to create a reliable transport, because UDP by itself is an unreliable transport, doesn't have any built-in mechanism for retransmit.
So games are doing that, right? They build their own transport protocols on UDP. They have the same concerns.
You're right, yeah. Exactly. Now they're dealing with less total, generally an average You know, those are long but sparse flows by comparison to like, I just want to load a web page, or I'm scrolling through my timeline and I'm needing to load assets from the CDN into my mobile phone. So there's you know, really different behaviors that are going on there. But everyone is subject to this problem that you're dealing with an open control loop, that you're trying to measure and control something that you can't fully measure and you can't fully control. So it's an exercise in frustration in some ways.
And then to add to that, it's also the feedback is delayed, right?
Right.
Because the control for how much data TCP or any congestion control algorithm is sending is at the sender, but the congestion can be at any point between the sender and the receiver.
Right.
And if the congestion point is far away, there's just no way to get that feedback back to the sender quickly, like even in principle. And in practice, the feedback signal will usually go via the receiver anyway. So we sort of, you're always one round trip at least, right, behind the current state of events.
Oh, geosynchronous satellite with 600 milliseconds of latency meant that you couldn't use a traditional TCP-based control loop and get anything like more than just a few megabits of throughput.
Well, yeah, right, so they generally have hidden proxies with special protocols and stuff to mitigate that.
Yeah.
So maybe before we talk about some really interesting stuff that Bjorn's been working on with Delta Q and how to measure latency, the one extra thing just to add to this of the perception of latency is loss in the network doesn't create latency. However, loss in a reliable transport protocol creates latency for the application, because the application can't deliver the bytes until that loss has been fixed. So it's a little bit subtle, right? Like generally you don't care about loss, but your applications may really care about loss because they will perceive that entire round trip as latency. So it's the difference between network latency and kind of application latency can be very, very stark. So with that, Bjorn, you've been doing some really interesting things measuring latency with Delta Q and some other frameworks. Maybe we want to jump over there.
But almost before we do that, can I ask Dan, you know, we've been aware at Preseem that, you know, latency and variable latency is the cause of a lot of pain for many years.
Oh, yeah.
Why is it that it's taken so long for let's call it the rest of the internet as a whole to really recognize this, or ISPs as a whole? If we want to say that, you know, gamers have been aware of this problem for a long time, but we're just now beginning to see. And I'll let you two talk a little bit more about, you know, which companies are really bringing this to the attention of end users, and why, and whether that, what effect that's going to have on ISPs.
It's not so easy to pin down the reason, I think, for that, because it's sort of, as you say, I mean, gamers are very aware that latency is a problem, but I think it partly comes down to the fact that it's a bit hard to measure the problems associated with latency, because if you just measure the average latency, you are not really getting any signal. Like the average latency can be great, and then your experience can be bad.
Right.
So it's like, it's not always sort of a one-to-one relationship between those numbers. And then there also hasn't been a lot of competition, I think, in between the ISPs. So it's not like you can change to an ISP that has vastly better latency, or it hasn't been the case, at least, that you can do that.
Mm-hmm. I think following a little bit on that, it is much more difficult to measure. Like throughput, you can sum bytes over 5 minutes, you can divide it out and you can measure throughput. Latency, you need to have constant, like almost like round trip level information to really say anything intelligent at all. So on one hand, it's just harder to measure. So maybe that's why it got measured later. And then people don't, or companies and customers don't understand latency targets. So our, you know, broadband plans are marketed at 300 meg or a gig. They're not marketed at 300 meg and 10 millisecond peak latency.
Right.
Yeah. On one hand, people wouldn't understand it anyway, but if it's not something you sell based on, it's kind of hard to get dollars to optimize for it. I think kind of how that plays.
We're seeing some really useful measurements. You know, Apple was one of the first to put a latency measurement tool right in the operating system a few years ago, where, you know, measuring the effectiveness of the connection off of, you know, essentially how many round trip operations you can perform. Now, they didn't make it consumer friendly. It's a command line tool, so that's kind of very, very non-Apple. So Apple is, you know, they haven't yet put it in the Wi-Fi symbol to tell you, you know, how well your Wi-Fi is working, but it's there. And then we've seen some additional improvements just in the past calendar year, I think, with both Ookla and Cloudflare, where they're really starting to measure latency, you know, under load. So when the network is kind of at its worst, I mean, you gave the example, Bjørnivar, where you're, if you're just one flow using all of the equipment, you can, you know, you are all of the load that there is, and it's not a complex measurement problem. But once you are attempting to determine what's the worst case scenario, and as we'll get into later, what causes the problem, you have this measurement problem where if you are the flow, so if you are on the consumer equipment measuring the end-to-end flow, that's the only information you have. You don't have any information about the congestion levels directly. We'll get into a little bit of this more with this at Delta Q, but you have to be able to aggregate samples from different points along the, if you think of it like a decision tree, where you know, a big pipe is coming from the internet and then being divided into successively smaller and smaller pipes as you get spread out into the edge of the network. Measuring congestion at kind of each of those points is required if you're going to actually understand which of the samples are experiencing elevated latency due to excessive load.
Yeah, I think all of the measurement tools that you mentioned, Ookla, Cloudflare, Apple's RPM tool, they're all measuring what's called working latency or latency under load. So they're all generating their own load and then measuring latency. And then you're getting a much better proxy for the worst case performance, or for the likely performance when you're doing something interactive while others are using the network, or when you yourself are using the network for other things at the same time.
So that's a really good point, that where they're actually injecting packets in the wire and stressing the network and detecting what it's like under stress. We don't do that at Preseam, and we could talk a little bit more about that, but I'm kind of interested in knowing a little bit more about how you've been measuring latency, and in particular, you know, the attenuation of network quality that comes with increased latency. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, yes. So for my PhD and for my work at Domos as well, I've been working with this quality metric called quality attenuation, or delta Q for short. And the whole motivation for that metric and sort of the associated mathematics and stuff is this insight that what users care about is whether or not their applications will work well. So, and that is typically down to how responsive are they, like how quickly is something downloaded, or how reliably are the frames of my video conference being delivered. So it's all about timings and delays, and the probability of those timings and delays being too large, like the probability of an application level outcome being later than you expect it to be, or that you require it to be.
Right.
So fundamentally, the application layer metric that matters is some kind of delay for some kind of event that you need to happen. And then what we want to do is to sit in the network and be able to measure something that makes it possible to compute a good approximation of whether or not the applications are going to function properly. And to be able to do that, we believe that it's fundamentally necessary that the metric that you're measuring is something that can be composed. And by composed, we mean like if you measure from A to B and then from B to C, that you can add them up to get the A to C.
Right.
And the reason for that is it's partially because if you want to be able to pinpoint where in the network your problems are, that's a useful property, because then you can sort of look at each of the segments and be able to tell where the problems are. But perhaps more profoundly, it's the property that makes it possible to compute the application layer outcomes. Because to take a simple example, if you want to know how long it's going to take to download, to load a website, and that website is a total of 2 megabytes. Then the steps involved in downloading the website are sort of the DNS lookup, establishing a TCP connection, establishing a TLS handshake, and then however long it takes to do an HTTP GET for 2 megabytes of data. And that's, if you do the maths, like that's like 8 round trips, something like that, because TCP has to ramp up. So you have like 11 round trips to get just the website. And what quality attenuation allows us to do is to measure, if we know the delay of the round trip as a distribution, So if we know the full sort of probability over possible latencies for a round trip, and also the probability that a round trip never happens, so like a timeout or packet right. gets lost along the way, then it becomes possible to compute a good approximation of how long it takes to download the whole website, because it's just the 11th power convolution of the round trip.
That makes sense. I like the approach of being able to, as you say, you know, both compose and decompose the quality of the network. We do something similar at Preseem. It's really not a direct A to B comparison in that we're doing correlation across different levels of the hierarchy, but it's not systematic. And I've read the white papers. It's really fascinating, and it's one of those ideas. I like the sorts of ideas that you can break them down into easily understandable steps, but nobody has done it before. It's like,
yeah, it's fascinating.
Why had nobody done this before? I asked.
I have to say that I didn't come up with this whole concept, but it's very powerful when you understand what it can do.
Yeah. We're coming up on a quick break, and we'll be right back. Hi, we're back. Dan and I here with Bjørn Iver from Domos. And we're going to hear a little bit more about how Domos measures latency.
Yeah, so as we talked about before the break, one of the useful properties of this quality attenuation or delta Q metric is that we can add up segments. And so clearly that requires us to measure different segments. And the way that we're doing that at Domos at the moment is we have software in home routers, home gateways, typically our Wi-Fi router. And from that point of view, we can measure the delay of the Wi-Fi link using various methods. So we're looking at TCP SYNACS. We're using ping for some measurements. We are looking at Wi-Fi driver data, and then using that to, along with a model of how the Wi-Fi protocol works, to understand sort of, or to get a good estimate of the latency distribution of the Wi-Fi link. Because if we know sort of a good estimate of how congested the Wi-Fi channel is, that allows us to have like a good guess of how much delay the Wi-Fi link is introducing. And then on the sort of other upstream side of the home router, we have also several methods for collecting latency. Or latency measurements. So we can use TCP SYNACS there as well, and just in the other direction. We can use a protocol called TWAMP Lite, and a lot of networking infrastructure support setting up TWAMP reflectors. So TWAMP is a protocol that allows us to get sort of one-way measurements in both directions, so you can get the upstream delay separate from the downstream delay, as long as the clocks are not too wildly out of sync.
Yeah.
We're using basically any tool we can get our hands on to get good latency metrics.
Awesome. So once you understand this, you've got your delta Q measurements, you know, both in terms of a sort of the absolute magnitude of the additional latency, and then the likelihood of that latency being incurred. What are the things? I mean, we're going to be talking about AQM, so I don't need to ask this rhetorically right here. Well, we've defined the sort of the buffer bloat problem, where the buffers get too big, as many of our listeners will know, managing the buffers is what we do at Preseem. Is there a difference with your approach, Bjørn Iver, or is it very much the same?
Yeah, are you asking what we do to mitigate the buffer
yes.
bloat? Yeah. So so Wi-Fi has some QoS or quality service features that allows different traffic to be serviced differently, and that is a simple way to be able to put latency sensitive stuff in a separate queue from the not latency sensitive stuff. And then there are better ways than that to manage Wi-Fi latency, but that requires driver integration. So typically, I mean, the reason we are not using those methods, such as fair queuing, CODL, all the great work that Dave Tott and Tuk Høyland Jørgensen and others have been doing on fixing buffer bloat in the Wi-Fi drivers on Linux, that, I mean, we would love to be able to leverage that work, but it requires integration with Wi-Fi drivers, which is typically not so easy to achieve, but we're sort of pushing to make that happen as well.
Well, and the problem there too is there's so many devices that are old that will never be upgraded.
Yeah.
Or have old chips that the driver's not going to change anymore. And yeah, it's a long deployment process to get changes like that made through the whole internet.
Yeah. So the short version of the answer is we're using the tools that are available, and then we're pushing to make more tools available.
Mm-hmm. Got it. So, you know, on this general process of, you know, let's measure the extent of the problem, you know, let's quantify it, figure out where the problem is occurring, and then, you know, apply a remedy. To what extent is that a band-aid, and to what extent is that just a reality? I mean, maybe this is for you, Dan, but a reality based on how long it takes to cycle code through the internet.
I don't think so maybe we should break down AQM for a second too. So
yeah, that's where I'm going.
So, every link should have some form of AQM on it. We have to be a little careful with the terminology. Sometimes, you know, we do this too, is we kind of conflate fair queuing and AQM. Technically, AQM is on an individual queue, like something like Caudle, and then you could have multiple queues per flow. Again, we tend to kind of mix those a little bit in non-technical conversations because it gets kind of abstract, I think, outside of that. But every link that could be a bottleneck, which basically means every link should have good AQM. That's the long-term solution to make this better.
And actively control the amount of buffer that's being allowed, right?
Yeah, that's right. So more intelligently drop traffic when necessary, so the transport protocols back off. And maybe even more importantly, this is probably out for some debate, provide some isolation between things. That's the fair queue portion, right? And even you think about that, you take it a level up, isolation between subscribers. Because
right.
If one subscriber can hurt another, that's a problem. If one flow can hurt another, that's a problem. So driving that isolation property all the way to the bottom does a really good job of making the experience better. And then there's other things you can do beyond that, but that goes surprisingly far.
So why isn't, because we're going to talk about this contention problem a little bit more when we get into L4S, but why isn't it that the problem of, you know, isolating the damage that one subscriber can do to another isn't just purely one of managing oversubscription, or is it?
It can be managing oversubscription, I think.
So fiber guys would say that we just need to go put faster glass in the ground, right?
Yeah, and I think that's true up to the point. But where you do have congestion, if you have a subscriber network versus like an enterprise network, you're gonna have subscribers with different plans. You're gonna want them to kind of get like a prorated share of the link and stuff. So you need some kind of subscriber awareness within those traffic envelopes to maintain that or to have that property. But it's really hard to push subscriber awareness down to every device in the network. Your edge gateway or something like that is just not designed to have that kind of information in it, like an access point, for example.
It's been interesting to hear the fiber world beginning to realize as well that they can't just simply sell a faster pipe. We're really hearing this rhetoric. You know, they are losing in the short term game, certainly to the fixed wireless guys. You know, looking at the big providers and where the gains are, and a lot of that is due to the fact that there are many factors outside their control, right? When we talk about sources of latency, Bjorn-Ever, you mentioned, you know, just the fact that you don't have good access to a modern Wi-Fi driver in some cases.
Well, and the fiber guys, it could be a 1 gig PON selling 100 meg plan. There's still something shaping that to 100, right? And if it doesn't do a good job, the latency is going to be garbage.
Yeah, and I suppose that's probably true even with the 10 gig XG, the extended PON, where, you know, the bottleneck there is going to be the fact that you can't get a home router a portable home router that can do 10 gigs.
And interestingly, I mean, what we've certainly seen with Wi-Fi is that as the speeds get higher, the buffer bloat gets worse, not better, because to get the higher speeds, you have to do more aggregation. So at the very highest speed, you're putting a lot of packets into a single transmit opportunity.
Right. Yeah.
And you so have to the wait buffer for has those. To, yeah, but the buffer yeah. has to be large enough to fit all of those packets. And if the buffer is sized based on number of bytes instead of the amount of airtime those bytes is going to use, then whatever fits in one transmit opportunity at the high rate is going to require hundreds of transmit opportunities at the low rate. So suddenly you're queuing hundreds of transmit opportunities just because you need to be able to hit your throughput targets for the really high rates. So it's actually sort of creating an incentive to make buffer bloat worse.
Yeah, it's the same thing that was happening on the wired side, but it's just, in the wired side, at least we were still always dealing with discrete packets and not with with aggregation. So I think it adds an additional layer.
We see this in fixed wireless customers as well, right? Like the big high throughput access points that are doing bigger aggregations and MIMO and stuff, they have to hold a little bit to try to form that aggregate.
Mm. Right. If there's no buffering, then there's no opportunity for multiplexing.
Right.
So maybe that's a topic for a different show. That's a fun one. Yeah. So let's talk a little bit, we have some time left here. Let's talk a little bit about L4S. What does it mean and how does it differ from kind of what I would consider to be very mature AQM technologies that, like you've mentioned Bjørnivard and Dan, we've been talking about FQ-Coddl and Cake and Pi, and probably there's at least one or two more that we could group under that. And under that field of, kind of traditional, we'll call it legacy AQM now, because it's definitely mature.
People like that. Is that true?
I was at a Nanog a number of years ago where one of the, I think Cisco was doing a talk on segment routing and used the phrase legacy IPv6. And one of the commenters said, thank you for using the term legacy IPv6 non-ironically. That's a fun experience. Cool. So yeah, so using the term legacy AQM non-ironically here, let's talk a little bit. I mean, maybe Bjørnivard, you can, I read your blog post recently on L4S over at Domos. Can you talk a little bit about, how that differs in your understanding of, what does it mean? What's the hope for it?
Yeah. So what the legacy AQMs, they all signal congestion by either dropping packets or tagging packets and then assuming that the TCP senders will interpret that mark in the same way that they interpret a dropped packet. And the new thing with L4S is that...
For the person who hasn't encountered this before, so the queue management software, if you will, the algorithm is attempting to provide better signaling to TCP than just a pure drop.
Exactly. Yeah.
How effective is that?
It is when the link is stable. It's very effective at making TCP behave sort of less erratically, if you like, because when TCP is in saturation, it ends up doing this sawtooth behavior, right?
Right.
Where it's sort of it's increasing
the amount
of packets in flight, right? And then it gets to a point where it sees a drop, and then it drops down to a much lower rate, and then it goes back up. And one of the benefits of L4S is that the feedback signal, that signaling congestion, is more nuanced. So you can signal, and that allows the sender to react less dramatically, so it doesn't drop as far when it gets a signal.
So it's pre-signaling.
Yeah, it's a signal that's not as that isn't interpreted as sort of brutally or whatever.
Right.
It doesn't react as aggressively. Yeah.
Yeah. So my experience, I have no experience with L4S other than reading the RFCs and stuff. But the way I think about this is like this lighter congestion message that we're talking about, like back off slower. The unfortunate part is that's fundamentally incompatible with TCP as deployed on the internet today.
Yep.
Right. Like you just can't do it. You can't, like, if it's kind of like what's being proposed for L4S is a variation of data center TCP, which is
That's exactly what it is.
Yeah. Oversimplifying, it's a very aggressive TCP. Oversimplifying, you can't run that on the public internet.
Of the endpoints, you can tweak the algorithms to exhibit any type of backoff behavior that you want. We've talked about this before. There's a number of different TCP control algorithms in the Linux kernel that long predate any type of AQM.
Yeah, but the difference there is they're all at least trying to be compatible. they can run on the same links. DC TCP cannot run on the same links. And Bjorn, stop me when I say something, because like this is all coming from reading RFCs. So I might be missing something subtle there. So what's neat about L4S is, and dangerous maybe, is they're basically slicing the internet in two, where you have one queue effectively, which you expect to have traditional TCP congestion control behavior, and one queue where you expect to have the new, faster, more aggressive one.
So can you, in the legacy queue, to go to kind of talking about legacy, can you run any control algorithm that you want? Like, can you apply
the internet today
to the legacy queue?
They all have to be kind of Reno compatible. So this is like, right. Think of this as like a new bit flag in the header that says, hey, I'm not Reno compatible, put me somewhere else.
What happens to all the equipment that would be, go ahead.
I mean, the L4S compatible flows will signal that they are L4S compatible. And then they expect to be put in an L4S compatible queue that will signal using ECN or explicit congestion notification markings in the sort of L4S compatible way, right? Mm-hmm. And then if there is no such queue, then L4S behaves as a legacy TCP. So it sort of backs down to the old version of the algorithm if there is no sort of correct behavior at the
bottom. What are the incentives to use the new one? From an operator perspective or from an endpoint perspective, what are the incentives to use the new signaling method?
Yeah, you get less buffer bloat if the links are stable and yeah.
So what if they're unstable? Because most links are unstable.
Yeah, that's a problem.
Yeah, so this is the really interesting thing, because so you now have these two lanes with two. It is a really neat idea, right? Like we have a more modern congestion control approach in one half. But to be compatible, as Bjorn said, if it is not fully protected, which means, in my understanding, if it sees a drop, it falls back, right? It's assuming then that it's not in the kind of special class, the special treatment.
You're asking two detailed questions now. I'm not sure about that.
Okay. I believe that's the case from the stuff I was reading. So I guess this kind of gets to the deployment, because we now need to have this kind of this dual queue setup in equipment. And that split needs to exist wherever there's congestion. Otherwise, it's basically just going to fall back and act like normal TCP. So as much as it's a really cool idea, I'm a little skeptical of how long it is before this plays in any meaningful way, because for one, you have things like random drops in Wi-Fi. If that's going to trigger a fallback to the other behavior, I mean, it's kind of hard to deal with. And even as you were talking about like the Wi-Fi drivers in like, home gateways, it's going to be a long time until everybody has a CPE in their home that can do this kind of 2-queue thing. So, but it is a pretty fascinating idea of having like a bit flag to indicate, hey, I'm doing a different style of congestion control and a more modern one. It's pretty cool.
Yeah. And I think those are good points. There is like, one of the good things about the deployment is that a lot of the actual congestion in the internet is at the edges, right? And in those cases, you can get the benefit, or most of the benefit, with just replacing a single bottleneck queue.
But that thing is going to be something big, like a DSLAM or an OLT, or
your whole home Wi-Fi router.
Well, coming the other direction, or the right? These are things that don't change that.
But uplink congestion is really, from our analytics, at Presame, uplink congestion is really not the primary, other than in cases, extreme cases of like act starvation, if you don't have enough upstream capacity to handle acts, but that tends to be rare. So to what extent?
That's a good question, though. Does that match with your measurements, Bjorn? Like that upstream is not typically, because you're saying you can measure unidirectional. Do you see much upstream congestion in the networks that you guys are in? From individual homes?
It's certainly less than the Wi-Fi, because the Wi-Fi is like by far the worst offender. Yeah. But it's not uncommon to have like buffer bloat issues on the uplink as well.
And by uplink, you mean in the Wi-Fi? Or you?
Yeah, no, I mean like on the access network, basically.
On the access network. I'm kind of mentally excluding here like legacy DSL, where you're dealing with like this highly asymmetric connection of a 25.3, for example. Although I guess even on even like my neighborhood cable here, where they'll happily sell you a 2 gig plan down with almost no upstream availability. Yeah. Upstream congestion does indeed become a problem.
And
I was just saying to finish that thought, it's just that the upstream congestion in the larger sense of upstream utilization versus how much total system capacity is provisioned. Again, it's always that upper 98th, 99th percentile that matters. So it might not matter that the median is beautiful.
Exactly. Yeah. And that's the kind of thing. I mean, if you have 100 megabit uplink, your 1 gig Ethernet connection can easily saturate that, right? So it's not completely, it's probably not an issue if you're looking at an average over a long time. But for those peaks where your router is like blasting packets as fast as it can, you can definitely have buffer load on the uplink as well, or on the access network.
Mm-hmm. It's fun to see that there's, you know, still innovation occurring, and that, you know, even though it might take a long time to roll out a new internet technology, at least people are becoming more aware that it's a problem, and that B, we can do something about it. You know, that's certainly been our mission, the mission that you started at Dan at Preseam, and it's fun to see additional areas of innovation with like the things that you're doing, Bjorn Ivar, at Domos.
Yeah, I expect we're kind of in the same boat a bit. It's sort of surprising how useful latency is in the sense of network quality. Like, on one hand, it's just one other dimension, like other than throughput, but it correlates so well with the general feeling of the customer experience and just general overload problems on the network. It's maybe not intuitive just how important measuring it actually is.
Yeah. The way you usually put it is that all your network issues show up in your latency measurements. Like if you have a network problem, it's going to show up as latency somehow, because if your throughput is insufficient, that means all of the buffers are going to fill and you're running at capacity, or you're seeing a lot of packet loss, right? And if you have a connection drop or a route flip or whatever, it shows up as increases in latency or increases
packet
in
out of ordering.
Yeah, or the instability of latency, or I mean, it shows up there because ultimately that is what the application outcomes
depend on. Actually experiencing. It's very, very much aligned with that. That's what we find.
So is there any final thoughts on L4S? Like you guys, it sounds like you've done some experiments and stuff, looking at a little bit of the content on your website.
Yeah, I think it's solving a problem that is important to solve. Like the getting better congestion feedback is a valuable thing to do. And then I agree with you on the deployment issues. I mean, it's going to take time. But I think it's worthwhile because it's moving in the right direction. And then it obviously has to be combined as well with solutions to the other problems associated with the latency and it's not a one solution that will fix all the problems, but I think it's a worthwhile addition as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the draft, the main IETF draft is surprisingly approachable. It's kind of like problem statements and, you know, high level discussion of things. So if anyone's interested, it's of all the RFCs I've read, that one's pretty approachable. It's worth a little bit of time if you're interested.
Yeah. Any last thoughts, Bjorn Ivar, or stuff you've got coming out soon?
Yeah. So I want to mention that we have submitted an internet draft for IETF that will be presented in Yokohama in March about requirements for a network quality framework to be useful to applications and end users, and at the same time being actionable for ISPs. And so the requirements that we're identifying there is sort of along the lines of what we've been discussing today, is it has to be composable, because you want to, when you're noticing that something is not working right, the ISP wants to be able to drill down and pinpoint where the problems are, right? And then the composability also gives you this relation to the actual application outcomes. So that's hopefully that will lead to good discussions there and better latency and measurement frameworks for all of us.
Awesome. So you'll be there in Yokohama?
Yeah, we'll be.
Cool. In March, Dan and I will be in Louisville at WISP America. So, you know, any of our WISP friends, please come and see us. Or if you are not a WISP, but you're getting into the wireless world, that's still a great show to check out. I'm looking forward to being back in Louisville. It's been, I think, 6 or 7 years since I was last there for WISP America, and hitting the Bourbon Trail again, that'll be a really, really fun time. Next month, as we said at the top of the show, we've got our WISP Virtual Summit that's coming out. So definitely check that out, ispvirtualsummit.com. And we still have our 2022 Fixed Wireless Report. That's a banner on our website, preseem.com. For those of you who haven't read it, all kinds of really interesting results from the way we measure latency, which is a little bit different at Preseem, but still really interesting things that correlate very strongly with the kind of results that Bjorn Evers has been talking about with what they've been doing at Domos. So different methodology, but with the same end goal. So yeah, send us any questions to our email. I'm jeremy@preseem.com and dan@preseem.com. Before we go, Bjorn, how should people get a hold of you if they want to know more about Domos and get in touch with you guys?
So my email is bjorn@domos.no. So that's bjorn. And I'm also on like LinkedIn and Twitter. And yeah, I'm sure you can find me if you Google my name.
All the usual. Awesome. Thanks for coming and being with us today, Bjorn Evers.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks for your time.
This was fun.
We'll do it again.